And so there's a lot of, I think that it would benefit everyone so much if we actually could get deep and thoughtful about what are the struggles that are happening and what are the demands that are emerging and what are the methods that are being used. But there's kind of like the thinnest coverage of what resistance looks like. And so people again and again think that the only thing that movements seek is recognition, and there's just the kind of sensationalism in particular around trans issues, so that instead of having meaningful conversations about trans politics, we have conversations, we have, you know, a TV show where we watch Caitlyn Jenner put makeup on. You know, it's like that is just these tropes, again and again, the same tropes. And so, I mean, this is a fantasy because in a lot of ways I just don't expect that we're going to see this from the corporate media. I think that, you know, independent journalism does a better job, although I think there's often, you know, work to be done because, you know, certain populations are underrepresented also in independent journalism. It's not like there's enough trans people who get to be journalists, particularly trans people from marginalized identities. So I think that we need to see change across all of the media, but I have very little hope when it comes to the corporate media doing much with these topics besides kind of repeating the same thing. I do think the independent media, and I use Democracy Now! As an example, I think that kind of our left media sources need to do a better job of reading the propaganda, particularly around LGBT politics, because I think there's been a lot of falling into it. There's been a lot of, for example, celebrating marriage and celebrating the military, which those organizations would never, ever, nor ordinarily do, but suddenly are willing to do when it has, like, gay or trans rights stamped on it. And I think in many ways that has ignored the left queer and trans critique. So I think that's one of the, you know, questions for the independent media to look at is how to better be tuned into the left queer and trans critique instead of, I think, being pulled into what, you know, what people call pinkwashing that's been happening, especially for the military and marriage. But, I don't know. I have to say, I can't say that I'm one of the more hopeful people around shift in the media, even though I would love to see something change.
I understand that thought. Well, you just mentioned it, and so I will ask you finally, talk about pinkwashing and talk about the film Pinkwashing. I don't have not too much time, but let us know what that's about.
Yeah, so I just finished making a film called Pinkwashing Exposed, Seattle Fights Back, and it just tells the story of a group of people in Seattle around 2012 who found out that this kind of Israeli consulate-sponsored tour was coming to Seattle and the Pacific Northwest region, which was going to kind of represent gay and lesbian activists from Israel telling a particular story about how Israel is this wonderful haven of gay and lesbian rights, which is part of a broader propaganda engagement that Israel's been doing for about a decade. And it's propaganda aimed to kind of make Israel look like this modern democracy and this place of equality using gay and lesbian politics as its frame, but totally refusing to talk about, you know, the occupation and the ways in which Israeli politics about harming Palestinians. And so these people kind of exposed this politics of these events and got some events canceled, and there was like a big, you know, hullabaloo in Seattle and in the region, and actually became kind of a national and international controversy. And so the movie is just designed to help people understand what this propaganda looks like when any country is engaged in it. I think the U.S. is also engaged in it, and what it means to be able to see through the use of gay and lesbian politics to tell a false narrative about a country, which is what Israel is doing, and certainly also the U.S., as we've been discussing today.
We've been speaking with Dean Spade of Seattle University School of Law. The book is Normal Life, Administrative Violence, Critical Trans Politics, and the Limits of Law. It's out now from Duke University Press. Thank you very much, Dean Spade, for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you.
6:02 p.m. KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Bread and Roses.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Montevilla Jazz Festival, Saturday, August 15th and Sunday, August 16th at Portland Metro Arts. The Montevilla Jazz Festival showcases the best of Portland-based artists, including the Alan Jones Sextet, the Ed Bennett Quintet, Machete Order, and Portland Jazz Composers Ensemble, and many more. Again, that's the Montevilla Jazz Festival, Saturday, August 15th, and Sunday, August 16th at Portland Metro Arts, 9003 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Music. on Saturday, August 29th, from 2 p.m. until 5 p.m., the revolutionary music and spirit of Miss Nina Simone will be celebrated by three generations of Grassroot News on KBOO Community Radio.
I put a spell on you.
Let us put a spell on you Saturday, August 29th from 2 p.m. until 5 p.m. with the music and revolutionary life of Miss Nina Simone, right here on 90.7 FM, KBOO.
Welcome to Bread and Roses, feminist news and public affairs on the KBOO airwaves since 1978, the longest-running feminist radio program in the country. Connect with Bread and Roses on the KBOO website, kboo.fm/breadandroses, where you can access our podcast and share feedback and show ideas. Like us on Facebook. We're KBOO Bread and Roses. Bread and Roses is a shared collective among women-identified radio activist, and if you're interested in joining us as a producer, host, or engineer, no experience necessary, please contact KBOO's volunteer coordinator, Ani Hines, at volunteer@kboo.org or call our offices at 503-231-8032, extension 213. I'm Adrienne Livingston this week, your host, and our engineer is Ian G. Thank you, Ian. Tonight on Bread and Roses, we have a mother-daughter dynamic duo for social justice. We will first speak with Marietta Gary Smith, the daughter of the duo, who is the African-American Sexual Health Equity Program health educator for Multnomah County Health Department, the STD, HIV, and Hepatitis C program. She is a graduate of the Center of Excellence in the Sexual Health Scholars Program at Satcher Health Leadership Institute, Morehouse School of Medicine in Atlanta, and has been awarded a Master's in Public Health from Emory University. Later in the show, we will have a conversation with Sharon Gary Smith, the mother of the duo, who is the Executive Director of the Mackenzie River Gathering, or MRG, Foundation, and has dedicated over four decades of activism and leadership to ensuring that our most vulnerable and affected citizens are included in civic discourse, especially those most impacted by homophobia, racism, sexism, classism, ageism, and ableism. Marietta, thank you for joining us on the Bread and Roses program this Friday evening.
Hi, Adrienne. Thank you for having me.
Definitely. So before we talk about your work and what you do, can you give our listeners a little bit of information about yourself?
Sure. I am a native Portlander, born and raised here in Portland between Northeast Portland, so I will say Alberta Park was my neighborhood park growing up, and Southeast Portland, my neighborhood park over there was Powell Park. So I had an interesting experience going back and forth between my parents' house and my grandmother's house.
Okay. So I read that you grew up in a family committed to social justice and human rights. What does that look like?
That's a great question. And I'm always intrigued when I get asked, certainly, in my sister circle of friends and other circles that I sort of weave in and out of, I usually tend to be the only person or one of few people that have a social justice, a very significant social justice background. My mom and I, we were reminiscing the other night about how with my grandmother, my mother's mother, family night at my grandmother's house consisted of us watching the national news. And my grandmother did a very, very much invigorating call and response kind of activity with the TV. So whatever the news was that she didn't like, she had a response for it. So it was like the journalist was calling out some kind of issue and she would respond like, no, that's craziness, or no, that's wrong, or no, that's unjust, or no, that's ridiculous, or no, that's disrespectful. Like there was always this alleged dialogue happening. So I grew up watching the national news as a child, having discourse and discussion about it at the dinner table. I grew up reading the newspaper regularly, Monday through Sunday.
How old did you start reading the newspaper?
I started reading the newspaper around 3, I think it was, around 3 years old. and then also I was raised, you know, going to protests. My grandmother was very much a physical in the space activist. So as much as she talked and did the discourse, she also went into the streets. So I was accustomed to leafleting and, you know, putting stamps on envelopes and folding, but I was also very much a regular at meetings and conversations. I knew what it meant to be arrested at 5 or 6 years old for protesting against apartheid. Like that was not uncommon for me. So I think my experience was a little unique in that way. My grandmother and my grandfather, he was sort of more behind the scenes. My grandmother was the one out front. My grandfather did the work in the back. And so that's how I was thrust into it.
And I know Miss Bobby Gary Smith.
Yes,
she actually served on the board of the Black United Fund.
She did, and loved the Black United Fund. Had a very soft spot in her heart for them.
Yes, I loved her, and whatever she wanted, I gave. I didn't fight with Miss Bobby Gary Smith.
No, a lot of people didn't do that. It just, you know, at the end of the day, it didn't matter.
No, she was passionate, and she had a purpose and a reason.
She was committed.
You could see that fire in her.
She was committed,
yes. So you also, your uncle Tommy Smith, he was the winner of the 1968 gold medal for the 200-meter dash. He's the man in the iconic photograph that raises right fist.
Yes.
That everyone knows about.
Yes.
I did not know that he was your uncle until researching you.
Yes.
That's amazing. So what did that teach you? What did you learn from that bold statement, especially at that time in our country?
Growing up, my uncle, my father's brother, didn't really talk to the younger generation, so his nieces and nephews, because I was born, you know, a few years right after that. His oldest son was born a few months before that happened. So we didn't really get to have that kind of discourse with them early on. He's become a lot more open about talking around his experiences and what happened. And so I remember when I was in sixth grade, I had to do a report and I decided to do one on my uncle because I didn't really understand what the gesture meant and what happened to him. And I realized doing that research that a lot of people were confused and didn't necessarily understand. But once I researched what the fist meant, what the black glove meant, what the shoes coming off meant, why he and, as I refer to him, Uncle John Carlos, who was the bronze medal winner in that race, why they had their heads down as the anthem was playing. There was symbolic nature behind every gesture that was made. And I think about those young men at that time, young African-American, black American men in another country who made a statement so significant that they were willing to give up their livelihood in a way, which they did, and that they literally stunted their ability to continue to perform at that athletic level because it was a statement of understanding the conflict and the place that they were as black men in America, and knowing that when they came back to the United States, they were going to still be second-class citizens. They were still not going to have the rights afforded to them as laid out in the Constitution or the Bill of Rights or anything else that had a legal connection to the government, so to speak. And so to understand how terrifying that must have been for both of them, but for my uncle to be partner, to have a child, to, you know, have family. My mom and my father at the time were at Oregon State and experienced a lot of kickback and backlash as a result of that. And so how his family was jeopardized as a result of his stance. And what did that look like for them? I think it's fascinating now to see him as an older gentleman and to watch him now, how he does not regret any part of what he did. And I learned from that you have to be willing to take a stand and understand what's going to come down the path from that, but to not be afraid.
Yes.
And to be willing to sacrifice something. I don't think he or my Uncle John at that point knew that they were going to give up their careers, their athletic careers in that way, but they were willing to sacrifice it for the greater good, for something far greater and beyond them. And I think you have to, for someone who chooses to engage in social justice work or be a social justice activist or to incorporate that into their daily lives, you have to understand that you are going to give up something, and you have to be willing to release it, which means you have to contemplate what it is you're giving up.
Right, but then you would also, as they saw, would be gaining, because the fact is,
yes,
they were second class citizens, so they had already lost.
Yes.
And they had to fight to gain what's really due to us. And I think, you know, even at this point in time, we have what's called Black Lives Matter.
Yes.
And I know people have said, well, why isn't all lives? Well, look at who's being killed just on our streets in America, and the fact that we have to fight for our freedom, which we were born in this country. We deserve, but yet, and it was built on backs of Black men, Black women,
yes,
Native American,
yes,
et cetera. So really, for all of us, it should not be one dominant culture.
No.
Like it is.
No, it shouldn't be. And I think calling attention to what actually is happening for so many folks of color in the United States is important, because the way that our society, for me, the way I look at it, the way our society is set up and structured survives on the consistent degradation of folk.
Yes.
It tends to be poor people, people of color, people who fall in other marginalized and identified populations. And it is set up to run that way. And until a collective group of people who are willing to step aside and step back and remove the privilege from the way that they live and how they exist and what they go through and what they have access to, until we're all able to understand what peace we have in that and set that aside and say, I want to do something for the greater good, or I'm going to sacrifice because I know it's going to benefit everybody, that it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Yeah. And Black Lives Matter is real.
It's real.
It's real. And, you know, it's real for people to, I'm not setting aside all lives matter, because all lives do matter.
Yes.
But in the course of my day as a woman of color in Portland, Oregon, I have a greater risk to incur some things. That's,
yes,
a fact.
Exactly.
So that's real. So yeah.
It's very real. So if you are just now tuning in, you are listening to KBOO Portland, and we are having a conversation with Marietta Gary Smith with the African American Sexual Health Equity Program, health educator for Multnomah County Health Department. And she is a person who was raised understanding and learning about social justice. That is in her being, weaved right in there. And we're just having a great conversation. So can you tell our listeners about what are those different things that your uncle did, from hanging his head to the fist in the air? Can you tell us what the significance was there during that time?
I can certainly do my best. It's been a while since I've recalled that. So the black glove that he wore, that he and Uncle John wore, was symbolic of the Black Power movement, or just speaking to the cohesion of Black Americans and also Black folks across the diaspora. So understanding that Black folks across many places were being impacted by racism and other ills, societal ills. The shoes on the feet were to represent the poor, so people who were disadvantaged, disenfranchised, marginalized, folks who didn't have access. Is that right? And then I want to say the hanging of the head was in relationship to the anthem. Even though they respect the national anthem, the words of the anthem did not apply to them. And so it wasn't a matter of being disrespectful. It was a matter of understanding that the words did not fit.
Got it. Hence, we also have our Black national anthem.
Yes.
Yes.
Exactly.
Okay. Thank you. I think you did a wonderful job.
Thank you. Thank you. Now he's gonna. Now when he hears this, he's gonna quiz me. What did you say?
Exactly.
What did you say?
Let's make sure. Okay. So when did you know that you wanted to pursue the work of social justice as a career?
That's a great question. You know, I don't know if I ever made a decision. I won't say that it was made for me. I think the work that I've always been attracted to, even as a young person, has always had some form of social justice or community base element to it. I think I really became enamored of the concept around social justice, sort of weaving it into my work in high school, when I was serving on the Planned Parenthood Teen Council, actually, here, years, a long time ago. And there was a discussion we had around how young people talk to their parents around sexuality or sexual health issues. And we were having a conversation and I was sort of like, well, you know, I was telling people, well, you, and we were having a conversation like, well, what do you talk about with your parents? And I was like, oh, you know, my grandmother and I, we sit and watch the national news and, you know, I read books and I read the newspaper and, you know, my mom and I talk and she talks about her work. And so people were sort of like, that's weird. Wow. And I was like, so what do you guys even talk? Like, that was my question. What do you talk about? And they were like, well, we really don't talk. And I was like, well, that seems like a problem. Doesn't that seem strange to you that you don't even talk to your parents? And so I was really intrigued by the fact that a lot of the social circles I found myself in, I tended to be the only person of color or one of a few. And that all of us who identified as folks of color had an understanding around community involvement in our lives. We had other mothers, we had aunties, we had grandmothers, we had folks who were very present, people who were invested and involved in us. And so it wasn't like if I didn't speak to someone in the grocery store and I didn't necessarily know who they were, it didn't matter, because by the end of the day, my mother was going to tell me about it, my grandmother was going to tell me about it, one of my aunts, a cousin, like somebody was going to call me out and say, you know, so-and-so saw you in the grocery store and you didn't speak. And it was like, well, I didn't see them. It didn't matter. I didn't speak. And there was a community involved in my raising. And so I think that sort of gave me a grounding of knowing that whatever work I was going to do, there was going to have to be a community element to it, because that's where I thrived the best.
Yes. Very relational.
Yes. Extremely. Extremely so.
I understand growing up in Portland, people would know me and see me. You don't want to get in trouble out
there.
No,
no. And it still happens.
Right.
It still happens.
It does. So currently you are the African American Sexual Health Equity Program Health Educator for Multnomah County Health Department, the STD, HIV, Hepatitis C program. Tell us more about this program, what it is, and who you serve.
So what I do, the short version is whenever I'm doing a class or doing a training or a facilitation, I always tell people I get paid by the government to talk about sex. That's the icebreaker.
Nice.
And it usually works. People are always sort of, they kind of give me this look like, what did she just say? And then it's like, that's a real job? And then, you know, like get into it. So it's always really good. What I do is my main responsibility is to provide community-based and culturally specific or culturally sensitive sexuality or sexual health education and information. So I work with communities of color, primarily African-American community here in Portland, although we've done some work with African immigrant communities and we've done some cross-cultural work as well. And so my main job is to make sure that the information, prevention and education information that we give is accurate, that it is up to date, and that it also is tangible for the community that we're serving. When we're dealing with people, we have to remember that folks are coming with a lot of other needs. And so sexual health or sexuality education may not be foremost for a lot of people, because they might be dealing with housing issues. They might be dealing with job issues. They might be dealing with transportation, childcare, other chronic health conditions. So my job is to make sure that the information I give to them is relatable, that it makes sense, that they're able to share it with other folks, and that they know where they can get access to resources if they need it. And so a lot of it really focuses on, like you said, relational, establishing a relationship and a rapport with people, but also creating spaces to have an honest conversation around sexuality and behavior and what does that mean and how it really does impact a lot of other decisions that you make. And to be able to encourage folks to understand that they have the right to make the decision around what's pleasurable, what's not pleasurable, what consent is, how they are able to exercise consent within their relationships, negotiate, and to own the fact that some people are going to have sex. And if you're going to have sex, here are some ways that you can do it safely.
Yes. And sometimes when you think of, because I see it's the STD, HIV, Hep C program, I think of people seeing this and hearing that and there are taboos. I don't want to talk about this.
Yes.
So what are those taboos, or what do you see as inequalities as well as inequities in your work?
That's a great question. Some of the things that I run across pretty frequently are as far as access. So there's a lack of access to resources. People may not necessarily know where they can go to get testing, to get information, to receive access to particular kinds of resources, be it contraception or other needs that they have. And that includes medication for folks who are on a medical regimen. And then also understanding that it is harder for some communities to get the information from a dominant culture or a mainstream culture, that it is a different relationship. If they've had an experience in a medical clinic or a healthcare setting where they felt like they've been slighted, or they felt like they've had unequal treatment, where they felt like they've been set aside. It's different when I walk into a room full of folks of color and they see me come in the room and they know that I'm here to talk about sex. And it probably is a taboo for a lot of them to have that conversation because that's not what they normally do. That's not something that's a community environment that's set up for them. That's not something that's necessarily happening in their families or their other relationships. And so when they see me coming, they're like, oh, that's that sex lady. But they also know that I'm going to create a safe space, that there's going to be confidentiality and respect. But there's also going to be an opportunity for them to just say what they need to say, and that I'm not afraid to tell them, you know what, I don't know if I know that answer, but my job is to figure that out and then to get back to you. And I'm committed to doing that. And so I think it's different when I walk into a room and create that space for people. It's important to be able to create a space where folks can come and do that. Because in a lot of places, they may not have an opportunity, or they may not know how to do it. And that is a challenge. Yes, when you have a lot of other things coming at you.
Yeah, it's quite fascinating and a bit sad, because when you look at our culture, you hear the music, you see the music videos, you see commercials, you see cartoons. I can just go on down the list where sex is prevalent. And whether it's a violent sex or it is a woman who just has to give in to her partner, it's showing and it's educating us about sex. But yet we can't have a conversation on healthy relationships and healthy sex and boundaries.
Right. And I think that's important. I think it's key what you said. You see sex selling a lot of things. So it's a commodity. It's commodified. And it's used as a way to gain access to get something else. And I think I feel like for me, what's important for me is to encourage people to understand that they can decide what that means for them. They have a right to make that decision, and they have a right to expect the people that they engage with, regardless of if it's an intimate partnership, an encounter, however you want to define it, you have a right to determine what that is. And then you have a right to expect that it's going to be upheld and respected by that person or these people. And so to have that conversation for some folks is really like expansive. Like, what is this? I have to talk about this. I don't, you know, we normally don't do this. And it's like, Yeah, I think you should. Encouraging people to own the right to pleasure. Like, you have a right to enjoy it. I would hope so for those who engage, because there are some who don't. And even that is a conversation for people, like, well, why wouldn't you engage? Well, some people don't want to engage in sexual activity, and that's okay. And you should respect that, because if you choose to, you would want someone to respect your choice. So it's just creating these places where people can have these conversations, but understand, you know, how all of this messaging that we get in the commodification of sexuality is really important to understand what that looks like. You know, for 7 and 8 year old children to have clothes that are extremely revealing, you know, or that show different parts of the body, like that's a conversation we should be having, you know, and what does that look like? And what does that look like for you? What does that mean for you? What are the boundaries for you? And so I think it's important to be able to create these spaces, especially in communities of color, where a lot of the images and definitions have already been given to them, as opposed to them deciding what they want. So I think it's really important to create spaces where people can do that kind of conversation.
Yes. And if you think about it, it's someone being able to say, I'm going to be countercultural. I'm not going to do what our culture says. And I ask that you respect my choice.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly.
Okay. Yes. So if you are tuning in, you are listening to KBOO Portland, and we are having a conversation with Marietta Gary-Smith, African-American Sexual Health Equity Program, health educator for Multnomah County Health Department. So you are also a member of the Women of Color Sexual Health Network. What is the purpose and the goals of this network?
So I am a proud member and actually a co-founder. There are three co-founders, myself, Trina Scott, and Bianca Laureano. We were a collective of women that attended an ASECT conference, and that's the American Association of Sexuality Educators, Counselors, and Therapists. So what happens for me is like all this alphabet soup starts happening and I get confused. We were at this conference in Phoenix, Arizona in 2008, and we saw each other at the pool during a break. We were so excited to see another woman of color. So we were like all giddy, like, yay, yay, yay. And I think our giddiness sort of disrupted the other folks at the pool, and they all left. And I'd never had that experience, but everyone got up out of the pool and left. And so it was sort of like, this is happening. This is 2008. And I was like, this is 2008. They got out of the pool. We're going to have a party. So once I got over myself,
yes,
we decided to sit down and talk about how excited we were to see each other. There were 15 women of color at this conference. There were over 400 people in attendance. There were 15 women of color. We were the three women that managed to get together and talk about what it meant for us to see each other in the field, and what it really meant to be able to see someone that looked like us and was doing the same kind of work and sort of have this validation that our work was necessary. And so out of that was the birth of Women of Color Sexual Health Network. We call it WOCSHN. That's our little name, WOCSHN.
I like that.
And so the purpose and the goals, we started as a Facebook group. The intent was just for other folks of color, primarily women of color within the sexuality field, to be able to just see each other, to just acknowledge and say, I see you. What kind of work are you doing? How can I support you? And to be able to have a space for us to just have conversation, to vent, to get ideas, to talk about what our future goals were, to provide support. And it's been an amazing experience. It is a national and international. We have a Facebook page, so we are on Facebook, Women of Color Sexual Health Network. We also have a website, WOCSHN, WOC, like Charlie, SHN, like Nancy, .org. And we have a Tumblr page and something else. I'm not too big up on some of the social media stuff. So
I
the three
you
of
hit
us.
Good ones,
okay.
Though.
And so we have folks from all over the United States as well as international. We have a large Caribbean representation. We have some sisters from India and Africa as well who are part of the network. And so we are really excited. Our Facebook page has grown over the last 5 years. We now have almost 1,000 members on our public page, within our closed group, which is really folks that are very much engaged sort of in the working, doing presentations. They write books. We have a lot of PhD folks in this, a lot of folks who are in academia and other spaces. There are probably around 400 folks in that group. And so a lot of the work that we do is really to just make sure that we are able to promote each other within this field, because there is a wide swath of sexuality education in our understanding that has been built on the backs of women of color, certainly. If you look at Henrietta Lacks and what she's contributed to the medical field as far as cells, the reproduction of cells, if you look at how the OB-GYN understanding or the Western idea of gynecology was built on the backs of black slave women, black American slave women. So there's a lot of history that we're talking about and that we want to bring to the forefront and give honor and space to. And that's why we wanted to create this network, so that we have an opportunity to have these conversations, but also for folks in the dominant culture mainstream to understand that we are present, and that for those that are willing to step outside of themselves and set aside the privilege, there are folks that can help educate and inform and even give a more expansive perspective to what they're talking about. And so as a result of some blogging and some letter writing and other things, our network has picked up a little bit more shine, and we're moving forward and really excited about the opportunities that are coming forward for us. It's a great group. I get my life, as we say, I get my life on a regular basis, just scrolling through the Facebook page. I love it.
Congratulations.
Thank
That's
you.
Great.
Thank you.
Tell our listeners why it's so important that we actually have a Women of Color network. You mentioned as far as having those opportunities to network outside of that, is there really any of that going on, or is there the space for that to happen?
You know, that's a great question. I think for the three of us who started this group, we were seeking a place where we just wanted to have space. It's hard. It was hard at that particular conference for us to be present in rooms and be the only one or the only two or sometimes the only three. And there were a lot of things that we were that were present in the room that we had to deal with. So we were dealing with some ageism because we were younger. We were dealing with the fact that we were women of color. We were dealing with the fact that we're non-traditional in the field. All of us were not clinicians. We're not therapists. We were not psychotherapists. We're not PhDs. But all of our work was valid and necessary and proven that it was important, and it was validated by the communities that we chose to do the work in. And that was outside of the spectrum of where we were. And so I think it's important to have that space, simply because we're present and our work is necessary and it's valid. And we weren't seeking validation from the dominant group to say, yes, you know, we see you and we're going to give you the space. What the group represents is that we've always been here. We've just decided to allow you to come play now.
There you go.
And so, you know, people have said that, you know, sometimes the group can, or some of the words or some of the blogs that we have published have been confrontational. And so I've always told people, I'm intrigued when people say someone or something is confrontational, because that means that it pricked you, not me. So clearly I've always been all right with whatever's happening or whatever I've said to you. You were pricked because there was something in you that was unsettled by what I said. So if we want to talk about that, that's what we're here for. If you don't want to talk about it, we'll honor that. Just doesn't mean that we may not work together in the same way. So I think in that space, that's where we are now, is that we're transitioning from this this network where it was really just sort of about, you know, making sure that we had community and we had sisterhood. And in the midst of all of that, we, you know, there's all the stuff that comes with sisterhood, and it's wonderful and it's a challenge, but we're all committed to doing it. So now we're trying to figure out in this new phase how we want to move forward and expand that.
Yes. Nice. So tell me, what do you want to communicate to our listening audience about sexual health?
It's changed a little bit over the last couple of years. I really am on this path where I feel like I want to, I really want people to understand that they have the right to pleasure. They have the right to enjoy their experiences, consensual experiences, and that they have the right to negotiate what that looks like, and that it takes practice, and it does not happen overnight, and it probably isn't going to happen over the course of several nights or experiences. It is going to take practice. It's work. And that you have the right to expect that, but you can't expect it if you're not going to do the work. And if you're not going to do the work, then that may change your expectations. Like, all of it is related. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really committed to that. And I also want people to understand that you have to decide if you're going to protect yourself every time you have an encounter, whatever that looks like for you. You have to make that decision. And once you make that decision, you need to make sure that you have what you need available to you to protect yourself. And if you don't know, you need to find out where. And if you don't know where, I'm the person to ask.
And how can they contact you?
They can contact me. My phone number, my work number is 503-988-3030. And you can ask for me by name or put in my name. You can go to the Multnomah County website and type in my name in the directory, and you can get my email that way, because my email is really long and I wouldn't even try to do it on the air.
We can actually put it also on the KBOO page.
And that would be great for people who want to try to reach out to our program. We do a lot of work with adolescents, and we also do work with families and communities. We've done some work within faith houses. So we're willing to try to figure out different ways we can work within communities and in collaboration with people, because it's going to take all of us. Mm-hmm. To make sure that everybody is fully and truly healthy the way that they want to be.
It really is that age-old adage that it should never die, as it takes a village to raise a child.
It does.
It takes the village to actually raise the community.
Yes.
And unfortunately, I think it's been flipped. And it's our media and the hype that's raising us instead of our community and our families and villages. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you and to learn. We could speak so much more. I actually have more questions, but we also have to get to Sharon Gary Smith, the other part of that dynamic duo.
That's right.
And hear from her. So I just, again, want to thank you for, you know, spending this time here on KBOO. Bread and Roses with me this evening.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I enjoyed myself.
Thank you. So we're now going to take a musical break, listening to the sounds of Spanish guitar. When we come back, we will be joined by the mother of this dynamic duo, Sharon Gary Smith, executive director of the Mackenzie River Gathering Foundation, aka MRG Foundation.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Bread and Roses, Feminist News and Public Affairs on KBOO Portland. We are pleased to be joined in the studio with Sharon Gary Smith, Executive Director of MRG Foundation. Sharon is a native-born Oregonian who is a second-generation social justice activist, having honed her craft for nearly five decades. She has headed up MRG Foundation, Oregon's leading social justice funder, for the past 4 years. At a time of significant increases in public presence, thought leadership, and innovative philanthropic initiatives and collaborations for MRG. She has been an active leader on issues of racial and social injustice and began her social justice organizing and leadership with a focus on reproductive rights and justice. Sharon, I met you 15 years ago when I first started working in the philanthropic nonprofit sector. I was so impressed by and in awe of you. I saw how you were truly a gem in our community, and I asked you to be my mentor, and thankfully you delightedly said yes. So thank you so much for mentoring me. I know and have been the on the receiving end of so many people that have poured into me, and you have been one of them. So thank you.
It was my pleasure.
And you know, I just had the pleasure of talking with your daughter, Marietta Smith, and you, and I should say Marietta Gary Smith, don't want to forget that, you're leaving a wonderful legacy. She is just marvelous.
They say you pass it on.
Yes.
And so that's what I've tried to do. I get fascinated listening to her.
I loved it. So tell me, where did you grow up and what was your upbringing like?
I also born and raised in Portland, Oregon. And that grandmother that Marietta talked about and my grandfather, her grandfather, my father, were activists at the kitchen table. Activists, when you were watching TV, they interrupted TV to talk about the events of the day. I think what was significant for them having four black girls, here we are in Portland, Oregon, I'm the eldest of the four daughters, that they wanted us to understand that our opportunities, our minds, our ability, unfettered, boundless, what we could do. However, the society, the Portland, the Oregon we lived in, had a stereotypical sense of us that was different than the us that my parents told us we were. I tell people often, it's become kind of a mantra. My mother and father said, never forget who you are and whose you are. And so they sent us out into this world that had a very limited view of us, empowered with our history that we didn't get in school, empowered with the power, the passion, and the achievements, the accomplishments of African Americans in this country. When I learned about the streetlights, when I learned who planted Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, when I learned about Charles Drew and the first blood banks, when I learned this rich, resilient history, no one could stop me or tell me that I wasn't, in fact, you know, a princess, because we were descended from royalty, from people who had dignity. And that was important in Portland, Oregon. And that I'm the eldest of four girls. So my mother and father would remind me that I had to teach by example so that my sisters could see what was possible, what was opportunity, and what was responsibility. So that rich, robust kind of family, it was all women. So, of course, there was a whole lot of talk and conversation that I was not limited, even though there were people who would challenge me, because my mother said they're confused. And so my father was a Tuskegee man. So we learned way before the movies, way before the honoring, even the apologies about the Tuskegee experiment. We understood this rich history of historically black colleges. My mother came from Kansas City. They came west because they assumed go west, young man, go west, young woman, was about them. They didn't know that the Oregon Territory was one of the most segregated outside of the South. They didn't know that they couldn't get jobs with their talent and their skill. So they made sure they impressed upon us that we had a responsibility to give back and to give our best. And so it was such a rich, colorful place that the dancing, the learning, the school lessons, the teaching each other. I was a happy Oregonian because I didn't let the real Oregon touch me in that way.
Or imprison you.
And I think so many people are actually restricted by the you can't do that teachers, or when they go into jobs. My mother said, you're overqualified for the least they can give you. And so some people might say it was a bubble we were clearly raised very middle class, but we were raised middle class with an incredible fist in the air and marching. And that's, so it was kind of that contrast that some people might say was a contradiction.
But at the same time, the fact that Marietta started reading newspapers at the age of three, how many of our kids don't even know how to read by the age of third grade? And they are falling through school and through the cracks. The fact that you knew to education was powerful, important, a part of that. And reading is critical.
And education outside of the schools.
Yes.
Because learning and knowing and knowledge are not always confined in schools, and especially for African American, other young people of color. There's far too much miseducation that is intentional, part of the system. So we were getting the news, the information, and it was being surrounded by a bigger world.
Yes.
I'm thankful I have my mom and dad. Frederick Douglass Gary Jr. was my dad's name, and Bobby Lou Mosley Gary. We used to love when they say my name. I love to say Frederick Douglass Gary.
I love those old names. The Southern, mine was Ruby Mae Erskine Bowden. There you go. What are the events, people, personal experiences that made you who you are today in standing up for the people and their rights as human beings? Can you point to different specific events or a personal experience?
I think when Marietta talks about, you know, my mother said, pass it on. You know what you know. And when I've done a lot of equity work, I've done a lot of work around race relations. It used to be diversity. I tell people it's equity now. When you don't know that other kids are not spending their Saturdays doing posters for protest marches because you assume everybody's doing it. When you watch your mother, her grandmother, be arrested proudly because she's protesting in front of the South African consulate because apartheid, and she talked about apartheid in Africa and the exportation of apartheid in America. When my mother proudly wanted to be taken away, even when the police officers would try their best, she would try to agitate. When she said, you stand up, you confront the systems of injustice. You make sure that people know there's not a pleasant time. You can't stay silent when your rights are taken away. Every civil rights movement, every social justice movement, people have stood up. They've loudly said, I have a right. I'm a human. And in America, you have to say it repeatedly to get to what I'd like to think the forefathers meant. So when you have that richness, that sense of purpose, and then you have to give back, those were the kind of incidents. I think the one thing, though, that really started me was reproductive justice. I'm a young woman. Marietta, going into it, I was a young woman. I'm the eldest of four daughters. If I didn't have a sense of myself, my rights, the opportunities, my right to say no. So I started in the place where I, as a woman, a young woman, it seemed natural, not just reproductive rights, but reproductive justice. Who gets health? Who gets the best access? Who gets information? Whose information is distorted? Who gets talked to and assisted? Who's told, I just think, you know, that's in your mind. When I learned the power of health or not having it, that's where I decided to start, because that is a social justice issue.
It's very much a social justice issue. Yes. You said that you are an organizer at heart in the Colors of Influence article. How has your work changed over the years?
I think that I've always used, and I try to always keep a social justice organizing mindset. Clearly, I've moved more and more where I have been director of, administrator of, and now the ED, the executive director of Oregon's leading social justice foundation. But in my heart, I'm an organizer, which means I look at the problems. My analysis is a racial and social justice analysis. I bring that to looking at housing, healthcare, inequity in schools, the criminal injustice system. All of that requires me to put on that organizer's head. How do you mobilize people? How do you inform them about why this matters? Where are the connections between these issues? What are the systems that oppress, neglect, and make voiceless so many of us? And then as I've worked in administration, I always want to be able to not get too far removed from where the problems are addressed, where the solutions are possible. And so I balance that. I understand administration being the one who sets the dream or has the vision, but it takes an organizer's head to be able to articulate that vision to others, to get people to join in it, because that's what an organizer does, to get people to say, I believe this is my part, and together we move forward to what will be a successful collusion, a successful decision. For me, that would be in Oregon, because this is my state, that is socially just, where it thrives and we all thrive, where the zestfulness, where the security of home, cover, shelter, food, education, health, that Oregon all of us deserve. And so if I can articulate that and keep finding ways for people to come together, to get inspired, to be ignited, then that's the work that an organizer does.
Nice. So you've been doing this work nearly 5 decades.
Absolutely.
You've seen a lot of ups and downs. How would you compare or just measure, has there truly been change? Has there been headway, or have there been times where it has, you've kind of taken steps back?
I sometimes want to compare it to a runner. You know, first of all, social justice and change in this world, racial equity, it's a marathon. It's not a sprint. And so I always think about what it's like when you run into a headwind, that there are measurable changes. I look at what MRG has funded. We fund groups on the ground, grassroots groups, who have the integrity, the community accountability, and they have solutions based on what they know does and doesn't work. We put our money, we seed those groups because they are moving people forward. The place that Oregon is on immigration, and the last time I looked, America was a country of immigrants. And so this sudden desire, as immigration has gotten darker, and I like to call it what it is, that people suddenly want to talk about closing our borders. Had that happened before, the people who are talking about it wouldn't be here. So I want to be very conscious about how we've moved on immigration, how the young people who were brought here undocumented a few years ago before President Obama did his executive order. If a child was brought here seeking a better country, which is what everybody goes, why you come to America? You come for a better chance and a better opportunity. Those young people completing school, but being charged foreign student admission at our colleges and university. We funded the collection of young people who organized in all these various community groups, grassroots groups, who got tuition equity passed last year. Where is that compared to 5, 10, 15 years ago? Where we are on equity, where it was literally you could go to government services, city, county, you could look at the school district, you could look at now the city council and the county council still are not particularly diverse and representative, but we've moved those. We are seeing some of the change, slow, sometimes I say glacial. We look at healthcare. Oregon's one of the first ones. The Oregon Health Plan. So we can look at who gets covered, who has an opportunity to at least get up under it. Do we have a lot to do? The retrenchment in this country, I say racism went underground, and now it's exploded with the murders of, and they are murders of unarmed black men and women. For me, it feels like history is in the current moment. Because the bodies of black people, black women, black men, have always had an expiration tag on them in this country, whether it was hanging and lynching, whether it was slavery, whether it was the rape of black women. So here we are again. So we know that we have to keep working. But our foundation is committed to seeding, to resourcing, to providing the technical assistance, and to seeing the igniting of people power. That'll make Oregon the Oregon we all deserve.
Yes. So what is then the mission of Mackenzie River Gathering Foundation?
MRG, Mackenzie River Gathering Foundation, was created to provide an opportunity to fund first the anti-war and peace movements. But our work is to ensure that racial, social, economic, and environmental justice is realized in this state. Whether your zip code, your gender, your sexual expression, your sexual orientation, your age, your ability. We want each of us to be able to thrive in the state we live and contribute to. And so we are committed to realizing that Oregon where justice is achieved. Our annual event is called Justice Within Reach, and we are reaching toward it. Our grantees are giving stories of success, and they return right to the front lines, because you don't rest that long when you're trying to achieve justice for all.
No. So if you are just now tuning into KBOO Portland, we are having a wonderful conversation with Sharon Gary Smith, Executive Director of the McKenzie River Gathering Foundation. So if we have a listener out there that is working with a foundation and they are working on social justice issues, how can they find you?
If they're a foundation that's working on social justice issues, and there are just a few of us among the larger field of more traditional philanthropy, first, I'd love to know who they are and for them to call me. I can name a few foundations that have a dedication, if you will, explicitly to social justice. MRG Foundation, you can find our website, and it's www.mrgfoundation.org. They can go to our Facebook page, MRG Foundation. We do stories. We put our grantee highlights. We have an activist grant making committee twice a year. We award grants to grassroots groups that are doing the work to push Oregon to the Oregon we all deserve. We'll be 40 years old next year, 2016. And we have given out nearly $14 million in our almost 40 years. We give out over $500,000 each year. That's small compared to some of the larger foundations in Oregon, but it's big to those who are doing advocacy and organizing, which many foundations shy away from. They think it's controversial or it might be difficult to measure. We're able to demonstrate how you measure progress to pushing racism and sexism and homophobia back. We can show you what difference it makes when the people who are most impacted are the ones who lead the change.
Yes, it's not always about just funding bricks and mortar. If you want to change the culture or the current per se, you have to look at the system.
And systematic infrastructure has been embedded with racism and sexism. And we say if you're going to change it, we're not talking about a little bit of movement here and there. You have to really dismantle the systems where oppression was built in. We say change, not just charity.
Correct. That leads into this next question. What do you say to a mainstream male Anglo-dominated organization or organizations that say they want to have more equitable social and racial practices, yet they seem to just not be able to advance or make change, or the change they make is short-lived? What do you say to that?
It's interesting you would say that. I've told my colleagues and the staff we sit in when we're talking, I coined the phrase that we are a listening, learning, and leading foundation. We listen to those who have the knowledge, whether it's cultural knowledge, place knowledge, historical knowledge. We listen, and not just, you know, parents could tolerate you. We don't need to be tolerated. How will I know you really listen to me? I'll see evidence in the work. It won't be the same work. We lead on what we've learned, what we know. We call people to conversation. So now that equity, I say, is trending, everybody's talking about it, but a lot of it is not different than it was before, just new name. Polished up, used to be diversity. Diversity, equity, inclusion require a personal and an organizational commitment. It's hard lift. I like to ask people, tell me, mainstream, more traditional, tell me why you want to do diversity, equity, inclusion, because the trend will pass. That means you have to think, but what is going to happen and what might I lose? And if you really want to do this work, what outcomes do you want? Do you want more representation of the people as the world looks around you? People think that Oregon is such a white state. It's true compared to others, but Oregon is so richly diverse that if people get beyond that assumption, the familiar. And then if you look around the organization, the richness of different experiences, the richness of different people at the table participating in the decision-making changes the decisions. And so if you really want to do the diversity work, then you're going to have to get in it And as Lily Tomlin used to say about chicken and flour, you got to get it all over you. You can't just kind of do diversity light.
You have to get messy.
It's an investment.
Very nice. We have learned a tremendous amount of information this evening from the dynamic duo. I like to say that, Mariotta Gary Smith and Sharon Gary Smith. Thank you both for being in studio this evening.
It was a pleasure.
Yes. So I hope the listeners can see why 15 years ago you impressed me and why I was in awe of you and asked you to be my mentor. And you still are there when I have questions like Sharon, and you're just there to support me. And I appreciate that. So for you listeners, thank you for tuning in tonight. If you want to listen in again or share this interview with others, you can access our podcast and share feedback and show ideas on our website at kboo.fm/breadandroses. You can also like us on Facebook. We are Bread and Roses. Jordan Coleman will be your host next week. As we leave you with the song You Gotta Be by Desiree, have a great weekend, everyone, and stay tuned for Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective.
Listen as your day unfolds, challenge what the future holds. Try and keep your head up to the sky. Lovers, they may cause you tears. Go ahead, release your fears. Stand up and be counted. Don't be ashamed to cry. You gotta be bad. You gotta be bold. You gotta be wiser. You gotta be hard. You gotta be tough. You gotta be stronger. You gotta be cool. You gotta be calm. You gotta stay together.